The border crisis has now been declared a state of emergency in the United States. Well, that's at least for liberal towns, where border states drop off migrants illegally coming into the country. We're going to give you the 360 view of how the migration crisis is impacting countries around the world. I'm Skynell Hughes. Let's get started. Right now, the southern border is overrun with people illegally coming into the United States. Though the administration will tell you the border is secure.
We have a secure border in that that is a priority for any nation, including ours and our administration.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis are taking matters into their own hands by busing these migrants to other cities in America who claim to be sanctuary cities.
I also was a little bit perplexed when I heard that the president is scrambling to get his cabinet together to try to address the fact that you have governors who are helping to relocate illegal aliens to sanctuary cities.
The border states are pushing back, and it keeps sending buses and planes full of people to cities claiming to accept migrants with open arms and promises to provide them with shelter and resources, all to help start their new life in America. However, only 4,000 of the 1.6 million migrants who illegally crossed the border have now actually reached New York City. But New York City Governor Eric Adams says enough, and he's begging the governors to stop because he says his city is already overrun.
If these trends continue, we will be over 100,000 in the year to come. That's far more than the system was ever designed to handle. This is unsustainable. New York City is doing all we can, but we are reaching the outer limit of our ability to help.
But it's not just America facing this problem. New leaders in Italy are now proposing an act of war to stop migrants from flooding into their country. They also signed a bill saying they will stop giving money to Syria because they have given too much to the country and they need to fix themselves now. Even one reason for Brexit was Britain wanting to have more control of the people coming into their country after a string of terrorist attacks done by people who snuck in under the guise of asylum seekers. And being a part of the EU didn't allow them to control. Now, at the beginning of the Ukraine and Russia's most recent conflict, people in Poland were leaving strollers for mothers coming from Ukraine escaping the terrors. Now people are done. They don't want to accept any more Ukrainian refugees, especially after so many countries in Europe have given weapons and billions of dollars to Ukraine for them to fight their own cause. And it's not just Ukrainian refugees. Remember in the tragic Afghanistan pullout? People were turned away by countries who promised to support them when they were trying to flee the Taliban rule. We are now joined by political commentator and journalist Bradley Blankenship. Bradley, thanks for joining us. Over the last few months, at least two European countries, Italy and Sweden, have seen right-wing parties win elections. This is all at a time when the EU has galvanized its states to sanction and blockade Russia over the Russia-Ukraine conflict. What is behind this political shift?
Well, I think that what's really behind the political shift that we're seeing and the rise of populism in general throughout Europe is the fact that people are just pessimistic about the future. And so they're looking for some kind of political movement or some kind of political community to latch onto to, help put their grievances into political action. And I think what we're seeing in Italy and in Sweden both reflect this kind of fear and perhaps people not being the most politically sophisticated in terms of their anger and hostility towards the government, but just wanting any kind of change at all. And it happens to be that the most organized political groups right now in the West, I would say, not only in Europe, but also North America, are right-wing groups. And so that's what's really fueling this push towards the far right.
Now, Sweden, which is traditionally left-wing, a socialist government, and often considered the poster child for the Scandinavian social welfare, they saw the Swedish Democrats score a major victory in their election. One of the main topics for the election was Sweden's migrant policy. A similar theme actually just occurred in Italy. Would you say Europe has a migrant problem, or are they just the scapegoat?
I would definitely say that they're the scapegoat. First of all, in terms of what's happening in Sweden, you know, there is this idea, especially amongst a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters in the United States, that Sweden is some kind of model of social democracy, right? But people forget that Sweden allied with Hitler's Germany in World War II. And there's a lot of white supremacy that still exists today in Sweden and all over Europe. Nationalism is very much alive in Europe. Any kind of pushback that you see from people, even against the United States, is not a rejection of nationalism or a rejection of the American colonial project, but it's really actually just competing nationalism in the sense that people, you know, Europe is where colonialism and white supremacy and all these ideas came from. I think it's no surprise that migrants are being scapegoated here in Europe, because that's, like I said, you know, these beliefs are traditional, they're indigenous to Europe. And of course, people are going to go back and, you know, romanticize some kind of folklorized, you know, romanticized past and cling to that. And, you know, I think that these ideas of scapegoating foreigners and others, as it were, is just another manifestation of that fear.
Okay, so let's say in a few months, this Russian-Ukrainian conflict, well, it's still going on. Meanwhile, Europe's economy, well, it's struggling. Gas is going to be a major problem this winter. Inflation is running rampant. And at what point do we see more governments actually move to protect their own national interest? Furthermore, I do have to ask, at what point does the migrant crisis become too much to handle?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the thing is that, again, with the migrant crisis, it's like there is a lot of refugees all over Europe from Ukraine, especially here where I'm at in the Czech Republic. We see Ukrainian refugees everywhere, but nobody's complaining that this is somehow a strain on civil services or on society in general at all. And so I think that the trumping up of migrants from places like Central Asia and the Middle East is just pure racism and European white supremacy. That's, you know, we would say that's as American as apple pie, but that's as European as, I don't know, whatever is extremely European to people, but yeah. As far as governments doing more to protect their own self-interests, I think that's the only choice they really have. I mean, here in the Czech Republic, on September 3rd, we just had 70,000 people protest against the Czech government, demanding their resignation, demanding military neutrality, demanding that the government leaves NATO and the EU altogether, and then initiates direct contact with Gazprom and other, you know, Russian gas suppliers. And so I think that countries like Serbia, like Hungary, which have secured these deals ahead of winter, are probably going to see some net benefits from that. And the countries that are most hostile to Russia, that are sanctioning Russia, are going to see, you know, bad things happen. People in these countries, like the Czech Republic, are going to look at countries like Hungary and look at countries like Serbia and say, why can't our government do that? Why can't we have these same deals, you know, that make our utility bills lower and help us get through this very difficult winter? And I think that's what's going to happen. People in these countries, they already are doing that. You know, that people in these countries are going to look at countries that are self, or, you know, looking out for their own national interests and probably be inspired by them.
Thank you. Now, that was political commentator and journalist Bradley Blankenship. After the break, we will continue our discussion on the migrant crisis impacting the world. We'll be right back.
Today, I'm authorizing additional strong sanctions.
Foreign companies are quitting Russia.
Haben wir Sanktionen verhängt, die ihresgleichen suchen.
ATM cards were blocked and banks disconnected from the international payment system.
Ces sanctions vont frapper durement la Russie.
Dollar and euro exchange rates followed.
У меня поначалу была паника, думала, что все, как мы будем работать.
Время тревог наступило, когда стали закрывать границы.
Подорожало все, все материалы, которые мы используем.
Can Russian business overcome this?
Санкции не работают. Для нас это хороший инструмент. Сейчас мы должны производить больше наших продуктов, наш сыр, нашу мебель.
В России такой потенциал, который ни у кого нет. Мы потом еще сделаем такой экспорт, который никогда не было.
Мы понимаем, что действительно от российского производителя ждут реального поставки лекарств. Теперь такое понимание, если не мы, то кто?
Нам не страшен никакой кризис, потому что мы проходили уже. Мы готовы работать. Я думаю, что мы прорвемся.
November 22, 2022. Outraged Orthodox Christians confronted Ukrainian security service officers, blocking entrances and exits to Kyiv's oldest monastery. They were looking for alleged Russian spies among the monks.
Мы имеем дело с именно с религиозной войной.
The former reason for the brutal crackdown, one church's parishioners had sung a song about Russia. It's long been reason enough to condemn any Orthodox Christian, attack, imprison, and even kill them.
Наши враги, наши оппоненты прекрасно понимают, что не уничтожив православие, они не уничтожат Россию.
Есть места, которые соединяют землю с небом, а есть места, где соединение идет с адом.
Welcome back. We are talking today on the 360 View about the migration crisis impacting the entire globe. We want to continue that conversation right now with Professor of History at Salem State University, Dr. Aviva Chomsky. Welcome, Dr. Chomsky. Now, we have heard a lot about this immigration crisis in Europe since at least 2015. Would you say that Europe is undergoing a migration crisis at the moment? Was it ever going through a migration crisis?
Well, you know, I kind of object to the way the word crisis is used, and I see a strong comparison here between Europe and the United States. That is, it's not Europe or the United States that's undergoing a migration crisis. It's the countries that people are migrating from that are undergoing crises, that are forcing people to migrate. They're undergoing economic crises, they're undergoing political crises, they're undergoing military crises, they're undergoing climate crises, they're undergoing food security crises. And those are the people who are undergoing crisis and who are being forced to migrate and are then being told, oh, but we don't want you here because that would cause a crisis for us. We don't want to have to face the consequences of our profligate living and colonialism and military involvement and exploitation and oppression of your countries. We want you to stay there and suffer.
Will we see more migration into Europe as the world struggles to heat and feed itself this winter?
So, you know, you put together to heat and feed itself. And I think that that those struggles are kind of happening in different parts of the world. That is, the struggle to heat, the energy struggle, is being faced right now by the countries that are big overusers of energy. That is, the European countries and the United States. They're finding their energy supplies being cut, their fossil fuel supplies being cut, I should say. Now, these are the countries that should have 30 years ago drastically reduced their use of fossil fuels, or they should never have increased their use of fossil fuels to the level where they were 30 years ago, much less the level where they are today. The countries where people are migrating from are the people who are facing food crises. They're the countries that have never had access to their fair share of the planet's fossil fuels, and they're the countries that are most affected by the overuse of fossil fuels. And the overusers, once again, are Europe and the United States. So the food crises are caused in large part by climate change. Climate change is caused by overuse of fossil fuels, but the countries facing the food crisis aren't the countries that are overusing fossil fuels. Now, the United States and Europe, and especially poor people in the United States and Europe, are in many cases facing a crisis of high food prices and high fuel prices caused by the development trajectories of their own countries that's over-reliance on fossil fuels and overuse of energy. Is a structural problem in these countries that, again, is not necessarily the fault of the poor people who are suffering, the ones who are suffering the most from it. But it is a structural flaw in the way our societies have developed over the past 100, 200 years. And that we should not have gotten to this point where we would be facing a fuel crisis in 2022 and saying, oh, but now we need to produce more fossil fuels because obviously we're too reliant on them.
What are parts of the globe are now hotspots for migration? We hear so much about the southern border in the United States, but what about elsewhere in the world?
Well, again, I think it depends how you define flashpoints. That is, I would say that countries that are responsible for the migration crisis in the sort of long durée in structural terms are also the countries that are creating migration crises on their own borders. And they're creating migration crises by putting up walls, by putting up restrictions, by militarizing their borders, by creating yet another crisis for the migrants who are fleeing the sort of longer in-depth socio-environmental economic crises caused by their relationships with those very countries that are now causing a crisis on the border. So we could say that these are hotspots for migration, but I think we need to be clear about how they become hotspots, not just because of the numbers of migrants. They become hotspots because of the military solution that the fortress countries of the United States and Europe have designed to what they see as a migrant crisis. They see them, the European countries in the United States define themselves as the countries undergoing a crisis of migration. They aren't. They're the ones who have created the crisis of migration, and their border policies are just one piece of how they are creating and exacerbating the crisis that migrants are suffering.
Now, are the conditions present, in your view, for increasing migration throughout the world as we move further ahead into the 21st century?
Well, you know, I'm a historian, and as a historian, I'm always a little bit reluctant to try to predict the future, because one of the things we learn in history is that unexpected things happen all the time. And at any given moment in history, it's difficult to predict what all of these sort of unexpected contingencies might be. However, I don't see very encouraging signs right now in terms of the kinds of changes to the global economy, global consumption of fossil fuels, and everything else. A global economy that continues to extract resources from the global south for the benefit of the global north, a global economy that continues to run on fossil fuels, as you pointed out. You know, we're seeing a so-called crisis of rising fuel prices because of the fact that our global economy runs on fossil fuels. And the beneficiaries, the architects and beneficiaries of this system don't seem to be showing any signs of wanting to change it. So the trajectory we are on in terms of the climate crisis, even if we were to completely halt the use of fossil fuels today, we're already on a trajectory, and it's gonna take a while to reverse, where the poorer countries of the world, which we should say are the you know, you use the terminology of third world or global south. And I think no matter what terminology we use, we need to emphasize that these are the parts of the world that have been exploited, extracted, and colonized by the global north. It's not just a geographic question of whether they're in the south or the north. It's a question of the history of relationships that have extracted resources from the global south in order to, for the benefit of the global north. So the trajectory of climate change is not going to reverse, even if we were to stop using fossil fuels today. And obviously we are nowhere near stopping using fossil fuels, even in the next decade or couple of decades. We're hearing some kind of lip service to reducing our use of fossil fuels, but it hasn't started to happen yet. And it needed to happen decades ago. So that trajectory, even if we were able to bring about the dramatic change of halting the use of fossil fuels or dramatically reducing the use of fossil fuels in the next 5 years or 10 years, which doesn't seem probable to me, it's utterly necessary. But the impact of climate change on the poorer countries of the world is kind of baked in for a couple more decades, no matter what we do. And if we continue on the trajectory we're currently on, it's only going to get much worse. In terms of the global economy, again, I feel like there is just very little recognition, acknowledgement, attention, acceptance in the powerful countries of the world that this economic system that they have designed and that they control in part through international financial institutions, in part through their own military policies and interventions and invasions, in part through trade agreements, in part through the actions of their corporations, is impoverishing and is a second major cause of, and you know, the two obviously are not unrelated, a second major cause of the migration crisis that is the crisis of the global south that is forcing people to migrate. So we need, in addition to fundamental structural changes in our use of fossil fuels, we need fundamental structural changes to the way the global economy functions. Again, these two are not unrelated, but I don't see a lot of hopeful signs about our trajectory on either front.
What are some of the difficulties migrants face, and how can host nations help them adapt to their new surroundings or to return to their home nations?
So I've been talking about some of the large-scale policies that the countries of the global north need to enact in terms of climate change and the functioning of the global economy. So that's one place where I would begin. Then there's a second piece of the puzzle is, so what happens to people when they get to the border? That's another place that Europe and the United States or the countries of the global north, you know, they all have a legal immigration structure and a border enforcement structure that prevents most migrants from entering the country at all. So that's a second place where I think policies need to focus. You're really talking about the third step, like after people have been expelled from their countries, after they have gotten through the human rights violations of the militarized border, after they are inside these countries, then what kind of policies can be enacted? And in that case, I guess I would say that immigrant rights are human rights, and that the idea that countries will differentiate different people within their borders on the basis of status is morally wrong. All of the European countries and the United States pay a kind of a lip service to, oh, we don't discriminate, we treat everybody equally, except not immigrants. That's obviously, we're not talking about them when we talk about treating everybody equally and giving everyone equal rights and believing that everyone should have equal rights. Well, that's just pure hypocrisy. Like, why should only some people have equal rights and other people should not have equal rights? How can you even use the term equal rights if they're not for everybody? But I feel like you're asking a somewhat different question too. That is, how do we address the problem of the mobilization of anti-immigrant sentiment? And I would also point out that I deliberately use the term mobilization. That is, I don't think that anti-immigrant sentiment just kind of arises naturally everywhere that immigrants appear. I think that politicians and media figures have played a huge role in mobilizing anti-immigrant sentiment for their own economic and political ends. So I think that advocating for the rights of immigrants and challenging the narratives that blame immigrants for the social problems that they are actually the victims, not the perpetrators of, is also a really important part of the struggle.
Thank you, Professor Aviva Chomsky, for joining us. Now, most countries would like to see themselves grow if they would have the ability to sustain the quality of life for their current citizens while bringing in those who would be productive and actually enhance society. I doubt there would be a few complaints if it was the wealthy and highly educated class, which were the ones composing the large migrant caravans. The additional funds being added into the community would actually be welcomed. In fact, we kind of already do this when a foreign corporation decides to relocate or open a branch. The community finds themselves thrilled with the new revenue stream. One way to stop an immigration problem is to make sure your country is less desirable than the one which the migrants are traveling from. Now, in the past, speaking of another country could be all dreams and fairy tales. However, the internet has made the reality available for anybody who really wishes to seek the truth. And while there are a few exceptions, the greener grass on the other side is starting to diminish. Sadly, in most cases, those seeking another country as their home are usually the victims of bad policies and politics. And whether it be war, famine, economic crisis, or security, it's the people of the lowest socioeconomic status who most often feel the wrath, while those who have the power in the land are rarely affected in such a dramatic way. In many cases, migrants have become a weapon used to weaken another country's stability. A country's economy and security can be destroyed without ever a shot ever being fired. Migrants are oblivious. They are being used by the politicians and the powerful to, in most cases, diminish the new home they seek to the same level as the one they wanted to escape. I'm Skynell Hughes, and this has been your 360 view of the news affecting you. Thanks for watching.